In a recent episode of the NPR podcast Invisibilia, a clinic at Children's Mercy Hospital got some major attention for their approach to treating pain in teenage girls who suffer from a condition called amplified pain syndrome. The main character is a girl named Devin. She's always been very physical. In fact, she used to be a dancer who went from competition to competition before pain took over her life. Something as gentle as the breeze from a ceiling fan suddenly made her skin feel like it was on fire. She couldn't tolerate pants on her legs or having bed covers on at night. She missed school. She stopped dancing. She started skipping most social events. And after a while, the whole family started feeling like maybe they were all just going crazy. This is Devin's mom.
I do remember one time when we were sitting in the doctor and they had basically just said, you know, you need to work really hard on your psychology.
When the source of the pain can't be identified, that's the conclusion people generally come to, right? It's all in someone's head. That wasn't helpful to Devin, who had practical considerations in mind, namely,
am I going to have to live with this the rest of my life? And if I do, then how am I going to cope with it?
The search for an answer to that question led Devin to Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, where they have one of just a few clinics that specializes in amplified pain syndrome. The clinic here is run by a student of someone named David Sherry, a pediatric rheumatologist with a particular outlook on pain. He thinks the relatively new practice of doctors asking patients to rate their pain and then dwelling on it has created more pain. He says giving pain so much attention makes it worse.
I think it is the lot of all mankind to and womankind to suffer. I think that that's just part of being human. I think there's some suffering that people just need to live through.
That's the philosophical basis for the style of treatment he prescribes for kids like Devin. He tells the host of Invisibilia, Elise Spiegel, that you have to put these patients in pain to help them get better. It's more complex than it sounds, but listeners reacted really viscerally to this story, which has inspired us to take a closer look not just at the Children's Mercy program, but at some of our most deeply held ideas about pain, causing pain, treating pain, and most importantly, living with pain. We'll want to hear your stories about that very shortly. I'm Gina Kaufman. Let's get started on KCUR's Central Standard. Dr. Kara Hofford is with us now. She's a rheumatologist at Children's Mercy. Hi, Kara.
Good morning.
You developed the program we just heard about at Children's Mercy after studying with Dave Sherry in Philadelphia. Is that right?
That's correct.
Help me understand the idea behind this approach to treating pain and all its complexity, because I think that the soundbite version of it, that you cause pain to treat pain, might be part of what upset people.
I don't love that soundbite. I don't think that reflects the relationships we have with our patients with chronic pain. It doesn't really reflect necessarily their experience, how hard they work to get better, and certainly not the nature or the rationale behind our program. It is incredibly complicated and more than we can even cover in this segment. But typically the patients we see have often had pain for months to sometimes years. No one's been able to figure it out. They've seen many doctors, had lots of tests, tried lots of things to get better. Nothing's working. My patients are typically incredibly disabled from their pain. They often aren't in school anymore. They quit their sports, their activities. They're not spending time with friends or family. They often become just confined to their homes. And so the approach that we take really is related to how this pain is functioning. And so first you rule out any underlying causes of pain. And if that's unrevealing, that sometimes leaves us with something that we tend to call within pediatric rheumatology or some of the pediatric pain centers, amplified pain syndrome. There are a lot of different names for it, depending on the specialist you see. So you could term it juvenile fibromyalgia, central sensitization syndrome, but ultimately
that must be confusing to be operating with so many different names.
It's confusing to the patients and their families. It's confusing within medicine. So it's highly unfortunate. And so it definitely, I think, lengthens the time it takes to figure out what's going on. But ultimately, these kids look very similar. Some of them have pain in one limb. Some of them have full body pain. Many of them have pain to even touch. Our patients have severe fatigue, headache, chest pain, belly pain, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, the mother of that girl we heard from was talking about sitting outside her bedroom and hearing that her daughter was up all night vomiting and then feeling like, well, I should wake her up to get into school and maintain her routine. But at the same time, I want her to sleep.
Right. That's a real struggle. As you can imagine, as a parent, you want to wrap your child up and hold them in your arms and protect them. But really, this is, you know, for lack of a better term, it's a nerve hypersensitivity. So basically, there's a lot of physiology to it. But essentially, the way I explain it to my teenagers is that normally pain is meant to be protective. And we have a pain response because we have an injury or an illness or something that triggered it to protect us. So if you sprain your ankle, you have pain, so you don't go run a marathon.
Yeah. And I've heard it described as it's there so that you take your hand off the hot stove.
Correct. Exactly. And so that's what pain is meant to do. But sometimes there's essentially what I tell my teens, a short circuit where the nerves go, things go awry, the nervous system doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And over time, what maybe triggered pain in a mild way, for instance, I had a patient develop full body pain after they bumped their elbow on a countertop. So it could be incredibly mild. Sometimes we don't even have a cause. Some people sprain their ankle or break their leg and then it just never heals the way you would expect. There's always pain there. So there could be a lot of different triggers or things that we can't even find out. But really what happens is rather than if you sprain your ankle, the nerve should turn off after a while once that's healed, that pain signaling should die down. But if you have a chronic pain syndrome, the nerves actually, what I tell my teens is they don't get the memo to turn off. And they continue to fire. And once nerves start to fire, the signaling gets bigger and louder, and over time, even pain that starts in one area can spread to the entire body. And you have nerves everywhere in your body. And so any area of your body, you can become hypervigilant to it, or that signaling can just become so amplified or really large that now things that should hurt a little bit end up hurting a lot, or things that shouldn't hurt at all, like light touch, can actually be really painful as well.
So you're trying to turn down the signal. And how are you doing that? My understanding, correct me if I've got this wrong, because I do think it's probably much more complicated than just listening to a quick story would help me get. But I understand it as if you respond to the pain that is being caused by something that is ultimately physiologically harmless by not doing that activity, then your nervous system is sort of reinforced in the message of, okay, doing that thing would be bad. When I feel this feeling, I should not do that thing.
Correct.
So the idea is do the thing anyway, rewire the nervous system.
Right. So our mantra with our patients really is if it hurts to do something, that's what you should do. So normally if you start to walk and it hurts a lot and if you sprained your ankle, you would stop. But if it's an amplified or chronic pain syndrome, if you start to walk and it hurts a lot and you stop, you just told your brain that walking was really dangerous. Alternatively, if you start to walk and you keep walking because you know it's your amplified pain and your tissues are healthy, your bones are healthy, you are generally healthy, then if you keep going, you're eventually teaching your nerves and your brain what is and isn't dangerous. And so it's a decision making that can actually start to affect the way that your brain interprets pain signals.
It's interesting to me because it almost, to my mind, sounds like we're giving like intention to parts of the nervous system that it's like as though they can be like making their own decisions. You know what I'm saying? Like, well, like almost like it's another person who is responding to the way you're behaving with its own like, oh, if I can get away with this, then I'll just do that.
I think that's a good way to look at it. So, I mean, obviously there's a lot more science behind it, but I think that's a way that is relatable and understandable. And so that's how we kind of give our teenagers ownership over that part of their body that's essentially misbehaving, is we give them basically a way to become functional because function comes back before pain goes away. Ideally, pain would go away and then you do all the things you want to do, when for our patients, in order to do all the things you want to do, you have to do that first to allow pain to go away.
Can I just back up and ask what got you interested in focusing on pain in children to begin with?
Sure. I did my residency in pediatrics at Children's Mercy, and we saw patients all the time through the emergency room, on inpatient, who were admitted for different forms of chronic pain. And there wasn't really anybody who treated that. They didn't tend to have a medical home. And they would be discharged, you know, back to their doctor, and people weren't sure what to do, and the families didn't necessarily have answers. So I always had an interest in that population. I didn't really know what it was, but I had a heart for them because those patients were so disabled, so frustrated. But, you know, I went to do my fellowship in rheumatology because I like taking care of autoimmune conditions. So I take care of kids with lupus and arthritis. And that's actually, chronic pain is not an inflammatory rheumatic condition. It just so happened that my mentor at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also in addition to being a rheumatologist, had a pain program. And I was so and so part of my fellowship was not that I had to participate in that, learn about that, but I chose to because it was so fascinating to me that you could have such a disabled group of people who could get all the way better and get their life back without using really potent medications or invasive procedures.
I do want to hear more about what it is you've witnessed, it, both as you were observing it then in Philadelphia and as you shepherd people through that process now here in Kansas City at Children's Mercy.
Sure. We witness a vast variety of patients and how they look. All of our patients are very similar and have a lot of things in common with their pain, but we see patients who have full body pain with pain to touch and fatigue and belly pain, who are completely out of school, who would be typically termed juvenile fibromyalgia. So we see that population. We see kids with complex regional pain syndrome, where basically a limb becomes cold and blue and swollen, and the brain even starts to dissociate that they have that limb.
Wow.
And so basically I've had patients that lose function of like an entire side of their body because basically the best way to describe it is the brain doesn't like what's happening. It's not really sure what to make of it. And so the subconscious starts to shut down that part of the body even exists.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I've had patients that come to us in wheelchairs. I've had patients that have not had their legs touch water for over a year because the pain was so intense. I've had patients get exploratory surgery because no one could figure out what their pain was from. And they did surgery to try to find something.
Can you describe a specific transformation?
Sure. I think, gosh, we've had several. One that sticks out in my mind the most is someone I met in clinic. She was about 16 years old. She had pain for years. She had full body pain, but her legs were the worst. She had been wheelchair bound for at least a year. She had not let water touch her legs for a year. And if you even just lightly touched her leg, she actually just would scream out in excruciating pain. And she would even pass out because it was so severe. And her brain would just shut down what was happening. And she actually just like lived in one room of her house. She couldn't even tolerate the, having the air blow on her legs. And she was, as a result of all of that, also had really struggled with depression, as you can imagine. So she had lost all of her social contacts, and it was really terrible for that family. And so we brought her into our program. And I think it's important to know most patients, by the time they do a pain rehabilitation program, they've tried a lot of other things typically. And so they've usually tried a lot of different types of medications and traditional medications people would use for nerve pain. And for a lot of patients, we are a place of last resort. And this was true for her and her family.
So what did you see happen with her through the process of doing your program? What did she do and how did it change her?
So within the first few days, we got her out of her wheelchair and we had her using other assistive devices like walkers and crutches just for safety. But even within a week, we took those devices away. She was able to walk. It just was incredibly painful to walk. And so the worst thing, so when you have pain, you want to curl up in a ball and not do that anymore, when really what she needed to do was to push through that pain and walk anyways in order to train her body what normal was. And so through that program, I mean, we had her in the pool within the first few days. So she was, in water and she hadn't done that in a long time. And so she was in, most kids are in our program for about 4 weeks. She was a little bit longer because of the degree of her disability and severity. And she is actually someone who does still struggle with pain to this day. But she successfully completed high school after the program. She went back to school full time. She was exercising every day, playing tennis, doing family vacations. And now she's in college and doing really well and successful.
So she struggles with pain, but it's not debilitating.
Correct.
You know, I can imagine that parents exploring this possibility of doing this program might be a little reluctant just hearing that that their children won't be protected from the pain. And I'm wondering if you see kind of two different ideas about what pain is and what it means to help, maybe even where we're coming from culturally and where we're headed medically.
I think the perspectives have shifted a lot over the years. And I think as a whole, with pain, whether it's related to a chronic pain syndrome without an underlying etiology versus now pain and symptoms associated with concussion, or even after you get your gallbladder out, the ideas are starting to change about how soon you should be active, start moving again, and start using your body. And so I think the overall shift in medicine is to start doing more and working to be normal sooner.
Alex Smith is a KCUR health reporter and also my husband. He taped some of the therapy sessions at Children's Mercy for that Invisibilia episode we heard. And Alex, what was it like for you as someone stepping into this whole scene without a background in it to see what they were doing and kind of wrap your head around both this condition, amplified pain syndrome, and this unconventional approach to treating it?
Well, I have heard, I've been doing a lot of reporting on pain treatment and management in the last year or so. I mean, I had heard a little bit about amplified pain syndrome, but this is the first time I'd seen it kind of in person. And as you can hear, I mean, in the Invisibilia episode, I mean, a lot of the treatment is pretty intense. I mean, I didn't personally see anyone struggling in the way that you hear like in the episode, but just, I mean, the physical workouts themselves are probably more than I could handle. I will say that the atmosphere of the program, I mean, is really nice. I mean, you have a bunch of women who have generally felt misunderstood, but, you know, in this program, they're all surrounded by people dealing with the same thing. And it really, I mean, in some ways, kind of felt like a summer camp. I can't really speak about the specifics of the Children's Mercy program, but I mean, I have done a lot of reporting on treating pain without opioids. And I mean, I'll say it's a difficult topic. I mean, there's a lot of research showing that non-opioid treatments and mind-body treatments can do a lot to help improve pain, but many of the patients dealing with chronic pain have really felt, you know, misunderstood or judged. And I think just the suggestion that, you know, some of these alternate treatments might help, you know, can really kind of feel again like people are just saying this is in your head.
Covering pain does get pretty strong reactions in general, especially now. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, just as I've reported on these issues, I mean, just almost every time I will get emails from people, you know, especially with chronic pain, who say, you know, that they're upset by this reporting. They say that it really reinforces the idea that, you know, opioids aren't needed and that opioid users should be switching to something else. I'm in contact with a lot of public radio reporters, and they say that, you know, they all get these emails. I mean, we try to explain that the reporting is not meant to be about, you know, pain overall. You know, it doesn't refer to specific it doesn't refer to all kinds of pain, and it's not meant to be medical advice. But, you know, it's just, I think if for patients that have been really struggling for a long time, you know, it can be hard to, you know, not feel like they're being scrutinized.
You did, as you've kind of alluded to, a week-long residency on pain research at Harvard, and it was specifically for journalists covering the opioid crisis. Do you think the opioid epidemic and growing awareness of it is reframing the conversation about pain?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that there is a big push right now to find, you know, non-opioid ways to treat pain. I think it's really hard on the medical side because, I mean, the opioid system is such a strong way to, you know, treat pain. I mean, it's just naturally that's what it's there for. And, you know, there's hope that there will be, you know, drugs that don't necessarily involve, you know, the opioid system in the same way that a lot of the drugs that we have concerns about now do. But that's still a long ways off. And I think that in the meantime, a lot of doctors and scientists think that the best approach for treating chronic pain is really a mix of, you know, non-opioid drugs and treatments along with things like exercise, meditation, addressing anxiety.
What are some of the things you heard about from pain researchers working at that highest level at Harvard that either surprised you or changed the way you thought about what pain is and how it fits into our lives?
Well, I think, I mean, as we've already heard a lot about already this morning, I mean, just the role that the mind plays and just, you know, one's own personal experience, what that plays in their physical pain. I mean, I think, again...
Which then remains real pain.
Right, right. And again, you know, a lot of patients take that to mean, you know, so you're saying this is in my head. And really, I mean, that's not really, I think, the way that this really works. I mean, the fact is that, you know, anxiety does affect the way that our brains process pain. I mean, it does create physical changes in the way that our brains process pain and our systems sort of deal with pain. And, you know, that we have seen that patients doing things like meditation or stress reduction can actually reverse or fix a lot of those brain changes. And so, I mean, I think that is, you know, really good news for a lot of people who struggle with pain, you know, but it is a hard, you know, it's a little bit of a harder road compared with just taking a pill and, you know, hoping that or, you know, in some cases experiencing pain going away.
Can you give an example of kind of like an alternative, what might once have been called like an alternative idea, just because it's not a medication, about treating pain?
I think meditation. I mean, you know, meditation for a long time has had a reputation as sort of being a little, you know, on the edge.
Woo-woo.
But yeah, exactly. But I think, I mean, like we had a great session about migraine headaches. And I mean, I had always, I think, kind of honestly underestimated migraine headaches and the way that they affect people. But, you know, this was a really pretty in-depth examination of just how migraines physically work, you know, in the brain and in the head. And, you know, this doctor actually showed how, you know, if a patient does, you know, meditate in the right way over a long enough period of time, it does, you know, like we said, create some of those brain changes that can help them to have less migraine pain.
Are you rethinking pain? Have you had experiences with doctors or others that made you aware of just how challenging it can be to come to a shared understanding of pain and what it is? Call 816-235-2888 to join the discussion. In just a minute, we'll hear from someone who studies pain at KU for insights into these larger questions. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've been talking about what you might call kind of a revolution in pain, both understanding pain and treating pain. My guests so far have been Children's Mercy Hospital rheumatologist Kara Hoffert and KCUR's health reporter Alex Smith. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
Hi.
Now I want to talk to Andrea Nickel, a doctor who teaches at KU Med. She specializes in anesthesiology, so her background with pain is a little different from what we've been hearing about. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here. Good morning.
Tell me about how your ideas about pain and how to treat it have evolved over the course of your career.
Well, so even in my early part of my career, when I was in fellowship, pain was kind of assessed in a way to where interventions were key. You know, with my anesthesiology background, we treat pain around surgery. So we're perioperative clinicians. And so we're very interested in how we can help pain before surgery, after surgery, and even during surgery. But it's all very acute. And when I decided to go into fellowship, I had to really switch that thinking to, well, these are patients who aren't having pain acutely because they're having surgery. These are people who are struggling with chronic pain for a variety of reasons. And when I was in fellowship, what we learned was, oh, well, if someone has this problem, here's this injection or this medication that we can use to treat it. And often those injections or medications we offered would not really bring home the kind of pain relief that people were looking for. And I think over time, I started to realize that you can't just treat pain patients in silos, with one silo being what you go to. You don't always just go to medications, or you don't always just go to an injection. And granted, these things can help some people in silos, and maybe just one shot will do someone great. But the majority of chronic pain patients, just as Dr. Hoffert was talking about, have this level of brain involvement in their chronic pain process. And unless you focus on what I call the three different silos of pain treatment, which are physical treatments, psychological treatments, and symptom management with medications or interventions, unless you're doing those things in parallel, in my opinion, you're doing your patients a disservice.
What, can you tell me more about these three silos and how they became silos?
Well, I believe they've all existed for some time, right? I mean, we are taught in our training, like, physical therapy exists, exercise exists. There's these people who are psychologists, but little did I know in my training that there were pain psychologists who specialize in ways to treat patients with their chronic pain by through cognitive behavioral therapy or acceptance-based therapies or biofeedback. And then medications are what we all learn in medical school. And during our training, we learn about them a little bit more in depth in terms of their pharmacology and how they can work.
So do I understand right, depending on what specifically you are training to become within the medical field, you are taught different approaches to dealing with pain, and there isn't a lot of
integration?
Yeah.
No. And I think that that is where medical education needs to go from here on out. I mean, I remember being in medical school here at KU in the early 2000s, and our pain portion of our education was literally maybe a couple days. And that's all we got about it. And I don't really feel like I even truly understood.
And that was even you were becoming an anesthesiologist.
This was when I was just before I even had my MD.
Right. Yeah.
And then when I'm in anesthesia, you know, we're using opioids and different types of medications in surgeries because during surgery is when opioids really should be used because that is a severe acute injury to someone that they need to get through. However, what I didn't know then was that moving forward, I had to think about it differently. And I wish and I hope that in the future, education for medical students, residents, all becomes integrated so that everyone's on the same page.
Did you have an aha moment about this or was it just cumulative, gradual?
I would say it was probably a little bit of both. I mean, I think as a clinician and as a researcher, we're always gathering new information. We're always seeking out additional information. And I get a lot of inspiration from my patients. I always tell them they do just as much for me as I hope I do for them. But I see a lot of patients with fibromyalgia. These are adult patients. I don't take care of children. But I don't joke about it, but I say, fibromyalgia found me. I didn't go looking for it because when I was trained as a pain interventionalist, fibromyalgia was somewhat of a kind of feared diagnosis to see on your clinic list. But once I started.
Why was it feared?
Because these are very challenging and complex patients, as Alex and Dr. Hoffert were talking about. These are very difficult cases that require a lot of time and effort and energy. And it's not always that slam dunk or home run. And I think it's part of our medical training and just how we are as people who go into medicine that we struggle with feeling like we can't make people 100% better.
I'm going to tell you just like a little story. I had an experience with an emergency room doctor once. I was having a medical issue that people generally agree is like way up there on pain. But it was a pain that came and went. So by the time I got past the waiting room, it was less acute. The doctor heard me out and then said something that I have remembered and that I think about in these conversations about pain. He said, unfortunately, doctors can't see pain. And it felt dismissive at the time. He sent me home with Advil, but I do not bring this up to gripe about it, but because in a way that is, it sounds like true and a true struggle that doctors can't necessarily see pain. I mean, in this case, a scan later very clearly revealed exactly what was causing my pain. So in this case, it wasn't true. But in this larger sense, that sounds like kind of a profound statement. Doctors can't see pain.
And I think in medicine, we're taught how to use imaging to look for things. Just like you mentioned, you had a scan and it identified the cause. Or you can do a blood test or you can put people through other varieties of testing. But I think the population that I see and Dr. Hoffert sees are a population where they're young. They look generally healthy. It's not like they're on, you know, some of them are on crutches, but it's not like they're on oxygen tanks. You know, those are very visible signs of illness. So what's really hard about this general population is they don't look ill. And when you're a physician, you're taught to treat illness. And so pain isn't necessarily viewed as an illness. It's more of a symptom. And that's where that conundrum is, right? Is pain a symptom or is it an illness? And in our case, as chronic pain physicians, it's both.
And that distinction between chronic pain and it sounds like what you would maybe call acute pain, that's different.
Yeah. So just like Dr. Hoffert was explaining, so you can have acute pain. Like let's say your appendix is about ready to burst because it's inflamed and you have acute appendicitis. That is going to cause a lot of inflammation and there is generally a reason why your peripheral nerves, meaning the nerves out in the body, are firing to tell your brain, ouch, go to the doctor so you can get this thing cut out. The problem with chronic pain is that a lot of times by the time a patient come to see us in clinic, that acute inflammatory process is gone. So there really is no reason for you to still have abdominal pain. What's going on is that the brain and the central nervous system have taken all of that chronic pain or the pain you've had elsewhere in the body and have led to different types of medical and physiologic processes in the brain and spinal cord that are then persisting that pain. And it happens to a variety of degrees depending on the patient.
You know, I do understand that anesthesiology is a fairly male-dominated specialty. Is that right?
Yes,
and,
it is.
And from what we're hearing also in these stories about mostly teenage girls dealing with amplified pain syndrome anyway, that pain and how we interpret it can also be very gendered.
This is true. Females are more likely to have chronic pain syndromes. And I will say that in my specialty, which is anesthesiology, and my subspecialty, which is pain medicine, that within pain medicine, we have even less female physicians and providers than in anesthesiology.
Dr. Kara Hoffert, jump in here.
I agree. So I think in pediatrics, we actually have a lot more female providers. And what's even interesting about our treatment team, actually, accidentally, we're all female except for one of our psychologists who's a male. But yes, about 80 to 85% of the patients we see are female through our clinic and our program, which is consistent with what you see across the country.
So how do you think that coming at pain from a female perspective makes a difference, or even just the presence of a woman as the doctor makes a difference? I am curious about that.
I don't think it has to. So I think part of it is our experiences. And I think something that's interesting to me about our team is that most of us can relate to our patients on some level, whether it's from our own shared past experiences, whether it's pain versus most of our patients are type A perfectionistic overachievers. About 90% of the kids I see hope to go into medicine themselves. So it's a really interesting, super smart personality profile in most of our patients. And so a lot of our patients, along with their pain over time, also develop anxiety and depression, which can be a result of dealing with pain itself. And then all of that can cycle in on each other. But I think all of those different experiences and even those personality traits have just made it where all of our team members relate to our patients on some level.
And that's helpful.
Very helpful.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think what you don't necessarily get from maybe the Invisibilia episode or hearing about, you know, we talk about asking our patients to do really hard things and to push through. What you don't necessarily hear is the amount of empathy that our team has and the way that we really connect with our patients and their families in a way that I think other medical professionals and different specialties don't get to do. So we really form these really neat relationships with our families. And I agree. We get just as much out of this as far as treating these patients and what that brings to our satisfaction as our patients do out of getting better. But I think it's really important to know that we really work with our families not to treat just the physical, but also the stress piece of pain and how it's impacted their life and how to re-identify like who they are, who they want to be outside of pain.
What do you think of the pain scale when you're a patient under almost any circumstance, you're asked where you are on a pain scale. And something I did learn from the Invisibilia episode that inspired this conversation was the history of the pain scale and that that's a fairly new development and where it came from, the idea of pain as a vital sign. What are your thoughts about this? Do you find it useful? Did it have a usefulness that now we maybe could be moving beyond? What are your thoughts?
to be honest, when I'm in clinic, I might report the pain score in my subjective part of my note, but do I actually take that number for really much of anything? The answer is no. I prefer to ask the patients a variety of questions to ascertain how their pain is affecting their perception of life, how they're able to function, if it's affecting their social interactions or their ability to do the things they need to do, like cook themselves a meal. So mild, moderate, severe is generally where I like to live with asking how, you know, the severity of their pain. But more than anything, I like to get a broader picture of how that pain is limiting their life, because that's where you should focus, is the function. Just like Dr. Hoffert was saying, you know, we live our lives so we can function. And unless you address the function via either physical modalities, psychological modalities, or even with medications to give some symptom management, you're really going to miss the boat unless you look at it from that angle. So I personally am not a big fan of the 0 to 10.
Alex, as you go forward in your reporting, do you have questions, things that you're still sort of wondering about, or just issues in pain that you're eager to follow?
Well, actually, I think pain is going to be a big topic area for National Public Radio in the next year. I mean, they've decided that this is something that they really want to continue to look at. And I think there is just a lot happening in this area right now about, yeah, just what are the best ways to treat pain, you know, that are, you know, things that have generally been considered alternate methods. I mean, with the pain scale, I mean, I can say at Harvard, I did hear from some doctors who right now are working to kind of develop a little bit more objective way of asking patients to judge pain by looking at their behavior, kind of like Dr. Nickel is saying. And I mean, to sort of take it away from the first person and make it more of a third person evaluation to say, you know, how does this affect, you know, your kind of day to day, your waking up, your sleep and everything. And that's not just to take it, you know, totally out of the mental. I mean, because that would include, you know, if somebody is, you know, really feeling down or anxious or, you know, just physically uncomfortable, that would affect their behavior, but it would just, you know, take it sort of out of the realm of just how do you feel right now.
Alex Smith, KCUR's health reporter, recent participant in a Harvard Journalism Fellowship on pain, thank you.
Thank you.
And Drs. Kara Hoffert of Children's Mercy Hospital and Andrea Nickel of KU Med, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I'm Gina Kaufman. You can talk to us about pain on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Up next, a Kansas novelist on seeing her characters come to life on screen. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here with Laura Moriarty, the Lawrence-based novelist whose book The Chaperone has just been adapted for the screen. It's a fictionalized account of a trip to New York that Louise Brooks went on as a teenager. It was on this trip that the silent screen actress was discovered. Well, she went on that trip with a housewife from Wichita, her chaperone, Mrs. Carlisle, and it's the housewife, not the actress, who takes center stage as the main character in Laura Moriarty's version of the story, as well as the movie adaptation coming to theaters in town this weekend. Laura Moriarty, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
This must be a really exciting moment for you.
It is. It's thrilling. I've had books optioned before, but this is the first time that it actually came about as a movie.
How did it happen? This is your fourth novel becoming a movie.
Mm-hmm. The audiobook was read by Elizabeth McGovern.
Of
Downton Abbey. She plays Cora on Downton Abbey. And I had actually, without watching Downton Abbey, I had named my main character Cora. So that's just a happy coincidence. But when she was reading it, she felt a connection with the character and decided she wanted to bring it to the screen. And so she asked Julian Fellowes to write the screenplay, and she helped produce it and make it come to life.
Let's hear a little clip from the movie. This snippet comes from the opening scene where Mrs. Carlisle, played by Elizabeth McGovern, as we've heard, introduces herself to a young Louise Brooks and her mom. Louise has just given a modern dance performance at a party in Wichita.
Mother, I don't want to do this right now.
I just wanted to say well done. I thought your performance was very exciting.
Exciting? I assume you're not from Wichita.
Oh, no, I am.
A woman from Wichita who believes in modern dance. I may need a chair, Mrs.
Carlisle. This is my husband, Mr. Carlisle?
Yes, he would be.
I was just wondering what you were saying earlier about looking for a chaperone to accompany your daughter to New York.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to propose myself.
Honey, don't you think?
I would. I'd like to go.
Laura Moriarty, tell me about these characters and especially the main character, Mrs. Carlisle, who we just heard saying something that I find so telling, that softly authoritative, I would, I'd like to go.
I like that scene because I think it captures so much. For one, it captures in what I did with this novel is I took everything about, I read Louise Brooks's biographies and I read her memoir. And so everything about her in the novel is true. And I use that as the scaffolding to launch into this imagined character of the chaperone. So even though she really did go with a 36-year-old Wichita housewife, I know very little about that actual person. She was sort of lost to history.
Yeah, there was like a couple sentences in the memoir, right?
Exactly. All it says, and her real name was Alice Mills, and I changed her name to Cora Carlisle so I would feel free to invent her as I needed her, and the only lines, as you were saying, in Louise's memoirs was, for this entire summer they spent together when Louise was 15, was, I tolerated Miss Mills' provincialism because we shared a love of theater. And so with that line, that I took that into Cora's character. I did make her a housewife, a Wichita housewife. But I also, as you see there, she does love art. She does love music. She hasn't been exposed to that much. And she's certainly not as sophisticated as either the mother or the daughter, Brooks.
Yeah, that's who you hear reacting like a Wichita woman who likes modern dance. I need a chair. That's the mother.
And the mother, Myra Brooks, was much like Louise, very beautiful, artistic, stifled in Wichita at the turn of the century, wanting more for her life. And she gives a little dig to Cora in that scene where she says something like, oh, this is my husband, Mr. Carlisle. And he says, oh, yeah, she would be. He would be. They were both very beautiful, cutting, sophisticated. And then Cora, on the other hand, is a very different kind of character. She's nurturing, kind, loving, a little provincial, but not wanting to be, really wanting to be exposed to more.
That these characters all meet in Wichita seems significant, and you, like your characters, live in Kansas, and it sounds like the setting is stifling for a lot of these characters, much like the recurring corset in this story. Mm-hmm. What has Kansas been like for you?
Well, you know, I really love Kansas, and I think it's stifling. I would say the Kansas in the novel is stifling for Louise, but it's more nuanced for Cora. You know, Louise definitely wants to be in New York and beyond. She goes off to Europe after this. Cora, you know, is Midwestern, and I love the Midwest. I got to live all over the country. My dad was in the military. We lived everywhere, and then I've gotten to travel quite a bit as an adult and live across the country as an adult as well. And when I got to choose where I could live, after I sold my first novel in 2003, and I thought, okay, I can live anywhere. I was living in Maine at the time, and I really thought about it, and I wanted to come back to Kansas. I love it here.
Can you put your finger on what it is you love about it here and what it is about working here as a writer that sort of clicks for you?
Yeah, well, just practically speaking, it's less expensive, which I think is really important if you want to be free to create what you want and have time to create what you want, and not have, you know, the difficulties of even, you know, really difficult traffic or anything like that. You know, it's just easier to live here, and ease of life can translate into more time and money and less worry to focus on your art, whatever that may be. I also, but on a less practical note, I just really clicked when I came here. You know, I came here for college. I was 17, and
KU?
Yeah, I did. I came to KU, and I liked the humility of the region right away. And I remember landing in MCI, and I've gotten to live in some really beautiful places. I went to high school in Montana. I was born in Hawaii. We lived in Virginia. We lived in Florida. We lived in Utah. We lived in some really beautiful places.
Like majestic kinds of beauty.
You know, the kind of places you go to for a vacation. And I loved it here. As soon as I got here, I loved it. I loved the rolling green hills of the Flint Hills. I loved that you could see the sky. And in fact, when I was living in Maine, I really missed the sunsets and the sky. Even though Maine is lovely in its own way, of course, with its coastline, you know, its famous coastline and the lighthouses.
It's very postcardy.
It's postcardy, but I couldn't see the sky as well. I missed the big storms. I think it's beautiful here, especially this time of year. You know, it's just breathtaking with all the trees going off like firecrackers. I love it here. And I also love, you know, I do think I can say this, having lived in so many places, that there is a personality to different regions. And there really is a humility here that I love. I love the, you know, you might say, like, Louise called Cora provincial. But I would make an argument that the Midwest is in some ways less provincial because we know we're the Midwest. If that makes any sense. We have this.
We don't think our experience is universal.
Right. We know where we are, right? And we know we're not New York. We know we're not California. I mean, an example would be, I got a fellowship in New Hampshire. And New Hampshire was beautiful, and I met so many wonderful people there. But I remember they make a big deal out of their trees changing color. And they're like, oh, you know, the sky's on fire. It looks like the trees are on fire.
They're like bus tours.
Yeah. But, you know, the trees do that here as well. And, like, we know that they turn red in New Hampshire. I don't know that they turn red here as well.
How did you become a writer? You thought you were going to be a doctor, right?
I did. Yeah, I did. I was pre-med. I got my undergraduate degree in social work, but I was also taking pre-med classes and studying for the MCAT. I wanted to do something practical that would help people. And so when I had my social work internship, I asked to be placed in a medical setting. And so I got to be a social work intern at Duchenne Clinic. I don't know if it's still here, but it was on Taromi across the street from Memorial Hall. And doctors across the Kansas City area would donate their time. They would sort of rotate in shifts to help people who were underserved, who were homeless or couldn't afford to go see a doctor. And most of the nuns who were actually working there were Catholic nuns. Most of the social workers who supervised me were Catholic nuns. And we would, you know, I would try to help people with getting rides to dialysis or coordinating bus rides to KU Med, things like that. So I was pretty serious about it. You know, I really wanted to merge social work and being a doctor.
What changed? I believe in the arts. I just want to say before this statement. But when you say you wanted to do something practical, like a novelist is probably like almost like in most people's imaginations, the like exact antithesis of that.
Exactly. And that's why I wouldn't indulge it. Even though I knew I loved storytelling and I knew I loved reading, it just seemed too indulgent to get like myself even take a creative writing course. You know, I was like, oh, no, I've got work to do. And so I really think I was rowing against my natural talents, my natural proclivities. And it kind of came to a head eventually where I realized, and I'm glad I realized it when I did, you know, I was never going to be great at medicine. I could keep up. I could keep up with my classmates, but it was harder for me just to keep up. And I saw that the way, like my lab partner loved it. For me, the lab was a means to an end. And for her, that joy of science was a means in itself. And I started to realize, you know, I started to look for things that I loved actually doing rather than being something. Like, did I want to be a doctor? Did I want to practice medicine? And I knew I wanted to write, not just be a writer. And so that's what made me shift focus. And I think that now, even
that
when
you're
going
to enjoy doing the
you
thing
have
you
to
were
love
doing.
Doing it. And I've seen that now with students who say, I want to be a writer, if they don't love writing, right? It doesn't mean you're going to love it all the time, but you've got to want to mess with the sentence until you can't.
The chaperone must have required a lot of research because there was like one part of the duo was a real person.
Yeah.
Tell me about the experience of doing that research, meeting one character and inventing another.
I really liked it. I did, because I have learned that it's not always a great idea to write based on a true story, at least for me, because the truth can limit you as to what would actually be best for the story. And then I've written books, you know, that are completely fiction and everyone in the novel is made up. But I liked this sort of mixed genre because Louise's life, which was very interesting, acted as a scaffolding, and then I could invent whatever I wanted to for Cora, you know, which I did. I just completely made everything up about her, aside from that one line that she loved theater and that Louise viewed her as provincial. That's it. But that did still leave me with a lot of research. You know, I started out, of course, I read Louise's biographies, her memoirs, but then I also, I had to read about Wichita in 1922 and get it really exact because things were changing so quickly that you couldn't even just look at the 20s because 1922 in Wichita was very different than 1926. So you really had to pinpoint it.
Wow. Well, are you going to go see the movie of your book in the theater now that you can?
Well, I am. In fact, I got to see it a couple weeks ago in New York at the premiere, and that was a wonderful experience.
Will you go in Kansas, too?
Oh, yes. I'm going tonight to Liberty Hall. Thursday. It's all a blur right now. Thursday the 18th, it premieres in Liberty Hall, and I'll be there. And I'm going to do a Q&A with Laura Kirk afterwards and sign books before and after. And then I'll be at the Glenwood on Saturday.
Laura Moriarty, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Laura is the author of 5 novels. Her 4th, The Chaperone, has just become a movie starring Elizabeth McGovern. And as you just heard, you'll be able to see it around here very soon. That's a wrap for today. You can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the weather has been weird lately. So have the words meteorologists are using to describe weather. We'll separate hype from reality tomorrow at 10, unless there's a bomb, cyclone, or polar vortex. In which case I might stay home. And that's it. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.